BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is a story that may challenge what you think you know about the threat of sexual abuse of children and young people in our homes.
The common kind of understanding is that this is carried out by adults and particularly by adult strangers, whereas actually the reality is really quite different from that.
It's also a story about human endurance, about worst fears realised and the battle to find a way through. How do you survive the unimaginable?
I was at a point where it was, I either tell my family or I kill myself. That was literally at the point I was at.
And how a reluctance to accept what's going on in front of us may mean that when people look for help, often it's not there.
I have identified such a high level of systematic and wide-ranging resistance to acknowledge that this type of child sexual abuse is happening.
I'm Livy Haydock, and this is Farlon 4. The story starts with an ordinary family living in an ordinary English town. Parents Tom and Kate, Ben from Tom's previous relationship, and their little girl Sally. They're not their real names.
I remember at the beginning googling, does this even happen? Is this real? I think people don't know what to do when it happens. It's too hard. It's easier to just ignore it, play it down.
On the face of it, they'd built a happy family. The kids got on well and life was good. But something was about to happen that would flip their world upside down. This is Kate. Her words are spoken by an actor.
I remember the day she told me, she kind of started crying, saying she didn't want to talk to me about it. And I just kind of explained, I'm not mad. I just want to help, but I can't if I don't know what happened. And she just said, can you make it stop?
I should tell you, what comes next isn't easy to hear.
Then she told me bits about what he'd done. She just kind of said, he pulls my pants down and he touches me and makes me touch him. She said, and I said, no, I don't want to. I'll tell Mum and Dad. And he said, if you tell them, they won't believe you. I didn't know what to think. I was shocked. I felt sick. I was actually physically sick. I felt like I failed. This had happened in my own house. How does anybody do something like that? But her own brother.
Kate had just been told her little girl was being sexually abused by her half-brother, himself, only a child.
The majority of child sexual abuse is carried out by people who are known to the children and very often other family members.
Dr. Peter Yates is an expert in child protection and social work at the University of Edinburgh.
The idea that it's actually siblings, the brothers and sisters, who may commonly be responsible for the abuse, I think is for many of us really just a kind of a stretch too far beyond what our common understanding of child sexual abuse is. What people don't understand and realise, but what we now know from the research, is that sibling sexual abuse may actually be the most common form of intrafamilial sexual abuse, up to 3 times more common than sexual abuse by a parent.
I don't mind telling you, before I started working on this story, I had no idea. This is a subject I'd only come across in those horror headlines, the ones you see in tabloids. And so, like a lot of people, my initial thoughts were ones of shock and, to be totally honest, extreme discomfort. As Peter explained, research in this area is patchy. Often they're working from small or older studies, which can make it hard to build a clear picture. But it's the best they've got. Discovering it was probably more common than I'd ever thought possible was a real eye-opener for me.
The estimates of prevalence across the population vary quite considerably in terms of how we define sibling sexual abuse. But even a very conservative estimate of a 2% prevalence, which is really at the lower end of the studies that have been done, would suggest, therefore, that in the UK, something like 1.3 million people will have been affected by it. It's very common and very widespread, every bit as impactful and as harmful as other forms of child sexual abuse. And it raises particular complications, I think, around how we need to respond to it.
I spoke to Dr. Yates from the BBC studio in Edinburgh, near where he works. We talked for over an hour. He was keen to tell me that not all sexual behaviour between siblings is abuse.
Some is totally normal. Curiosity, kids being kids, but admits it can be hard to know the difference. Things like a big age gap or power imbalances can be signs and in some cases overt coercion or force. But when it does happen, the impact on the family can be really destructive.
Because these are children and they're children of the same family, the impact therefore is felt beyond the children who are involved directly in the abuse. So parents will report that they can feel like they're really in an impossible situation, you know, torn between the different needs of their different children, can often feel, you know, quite isolated, ashamed, stigmatized themselves. It's been described as like a grenade going off within the family. And then you have to work hard to be able to pick up the pieces afterwards.
And in the family we just heard from, that grenade had just gone off. They had no idea what to do, but they knew they were worried.
I said to Tom, what do we do? He said, as soon as you go to social services, nothing is going to be the same. And I was like, well, do you know how to deal with this? And he was like, no. And I said, well, I don't. I don't know what to do. I need professional advice on this because something is amiss.
Even though both parents were shocked, if they were being honest, this hadn't come entirely out of the blue. For one, Sally had been acting out recently, wetting the bed, refusing to go to school. And then there was Ben's behaviour.
He would do certain things, like make her get naked or show her his bits. I just thought maybe he's going through that curiosity kind of thing. It started to get too much. I felt really weird and uncomfortable.
They spoke to Ben and explained that wasn't okay. They thought they'd dealt with it. But what Sally had told them put all of that into a new light. So Kate called social services.
I was a bit like a deer in the headlights. I was like, hello, I need your help. It was like,
yes, you're in the right place.
And I was like, my daughter's told me her brother has been touching her. And they were like,
oh, okay. Can you just hold the line a minute?
I think that I was like the majority of the population, which is I was completely unaware as to the extent of sibling sexual abuse within the United Kingdom.
Fleur Strong has spent the last 2 years leading a Home Office funded research project into sibling sexual abuse, led by Rape Crisis England and Wales.
You need to think around how destructive this can be and how catastrophic it can be for a family when sibling sexual abuse is acknowledged, turns everything that we want to believe, we feel comfortable in believing, it challenges everything. It turns it upside down.
She told me that when it comes to professionals like social workers, they don't always get this right. Sometimes they play it down. Sometimes they overreact and sometimes they exaggerate it to give families a fighting chance of getting access to what limited help is available. Why has it gone under the radar for so long?
There is almost a desire not to know. There is a higher level of revulsion, and I use that word carefully, but it is revulsion, around the concept of brothers and sisters having some form of sexual relationship. It is like the last taboo. It is something that people find very, very difficult to accept, and that includes professionals.
A few weeks after she called social services asking for help, Kate says they were told there would be no further action for their daughter.
She said she thought he was a lovely boy and she didn't think he'd done it. After it happened and we knew about it, everything clicked into place. The behaviours, the bedwetting, you know, the nightmares. So I just said, how can you say nothing's happened? Because it has. It genuinely is affecting her. And they told me she's young. She'll forget it. Like everyone told me the same thing. She'll forget it.
But she didn't. As the months went on, Kate says Sally became more and more distressed. Kate says she called social services to ask for help. She actually told me she begged and pleaded, but always the same outcome.
Before I even rang social services, I must have questioned her about 5 or 6 times. I wanted her to be lying. I remember telling Tom, I want it to be a big fat lie. I can deal with that because I didn't want to believe it. But then as time went on, she opened up a bit more and a bit more and a bit more. And I'd call them and say, she said this or she said this. And they'd say what they needed to get me off the phone. and then I'd get a letter saying no further action.
Kate says she eventually gave up on social services. In the end, she got a referral from her health visitor to a specialist counselling service for children who'd experienced sexual abuse. But she says she's still disappointed by the lack of help she received from social services.
To be fair, if I didn't need them, I wouldn't have gone to them. It was only because I needed them. Why couldn't they believe that it might have happened and help her? I couldn't understand why there was nothing in place. Why not? I'm not the only person in the world. Surely this has happened to somebody else. But it was like nobody wanted to listen. It was too hard. Like, I'd rather just not deal with it. I just wanted them to give her the benefit of the doubt.
We wrote to Kate's local authority to ask them about what she'd told me. They said they held a strategy meeting where it was decided no further action was needed to keep Sally safe because her parents were able to identify potential risks and protect her. And although they say the pandemic caused a delay, they confirm that Sally eventually accessed therapy after being referred by the health visiting team. They also said the case was discussed by their harmful sexual behaviour panel and a social worker carried out direct work with Ben in an age-appropriate way.
In many cases, children have some sense that what they're doing isn't okay because we find that they typically will hide it, conceal it, so they might engage in it when the adults aren't looking.
Dr. Oliver Eastman is a consultant clinical psychologist at children's charity, the NSPCC.
So on some level, they'll understand that there isn't something right about this, but they may not know exactly why.
He works in a specialist clinic that helps kids who have displayed harmful sexual behaviour.
Typically, this is a male problem. So about 95% of sibling sexual abuse is committed by boys. It is older brothers against younger sisters.
He says a broad range of kids get referred to him. Those who've experienced some kind of adversity in their young lives, things like domestic abuse or poor sexual boundaries, neglect or a lack of proper supervision. All kids who have learning difficulties or who are on the autistic spectrum and may not totally understand the consequences of their actions. And recently, he started to pick up on a bit of a trend.
So we looked back through our referrals over the last few years, and what we noticed was that nearly 70% of those children that have been referred to us had engaged in sexual behaviour with siblings.
And were you surprised by that number?
We were surprised. There was no clear reason for that high proportion of referrals relating to sibling sexual abuse. But it's challenged us recently to think about how we can best meet the needs of these families, because there are some unique features associated with sibling sexual abuse.
Before we go much further, I should say I've been told that when talking about this subject, language is important. People who work with these kids tend not to say victim or perpetrator. They say that kind of implies a clear-cut right versus wrong that doesn't always apply with children. Instead, they refer to the child who displayed or caused the harm and the child who experienced the harm. Dr. Eastman's recent discovery that the majority of their referrals involved sexual abuse by siblings has made them rethink the way things are done.
What we often find is that the child who might be labelled as a perpetrator, the child that's displayed the harm, they would be referred to a harmful sexual behaviour service. Then there might be the child that's experienced the harm. They will be referred to what we might call a victim service. The parents often, if they're lucky, get a little bit of support, but often not very much at all. And those other siblings in the home that have not been directly affected, they'll receive no support. So there's a very siloed approach to working with this area. And so what we've recognised is with sibling sexual abuse that we need to have a whole family approach.
The idea of offering therapy for the entire family does exist in some parts of the country, but it's patchy. Truth is, it's not available to most. Dr. Eastman says when he receives a referral, often from social services, an image is built up of the child or the family. Words like predatory are used, and the child who caused the harm can be demonised.
The thing that surprises me is when we meet these children is they're not monsters. They have very many redeeming qualities. They want to learn, they want to change, but also they want for their families to change as well. They are children who are trying to manage as adaptively as they can within the environments in which they find themselves. And that what we need to do as adults is to support them and their families to make changes in which they feel safe and protected and comforted, and so they don't need to resort to these behaviours.
There'd always been issues with my son. He's a hard kid. He's a lovely child, but he's a handful. So I thought he might have done something, but I could never have imagined it was this.
This mum, let's call her Jenny, knows what it's like to feel torn between her two children, between really loving a child but being completely horrified by something they've done, yet somehow finding a way through. Her whole world changed when she got a call from social services. Her words are spoken by an actor.
They came in. I just remember hovering by the kitchen and they sat on the sofa and then they told me. And I just couldn't believe it. I was so angry and upset and mortified. In that moment, I was like, oh my God, why was I so blind? How did I not know?
Can I ask you what they told you had happened?
They said that my daughter told someone that my son stuck his willy in her bum. I did feel quite sick to my stomach. My first thought was that I was going to lose the children. I just wanted the world to swallow me up whole. I just didn't know how to cope with it and process it all and everything. I just wanted to go and cry somewhere.
When social workers spoke to the children, they both admitted what had happened, which Jenny said made things more straightforward.
You must have been torn between the two kids.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely latched onto my daughter, without a doubt, just to try and keep her more safe. I think at the start, I kind of pushed him away because I really didn't think that he would still be in the family. I didn't really look at him. I didn't really talk to him. I couldn't.
You know, I remember first meeting this family at a school and it was extremely difficult. And why wouldn't it be?
Paul Kelly is a family therapist at a specialist service called Be Safe in Bristol.
Trusting me to talk about risky things that had gone on and their worries and thoughts about that. Why would you trust some bloke who's coming in a shirt and a jacket?
He was part of the team called in to help Jenny and her family after the abuse was discovered.
My memory from that meeting was, you know, a mum who struggled to maybe keep eye contact with me and to really engage with me, really. I can remember thinking how uncomfortable she might have felt.
Run by Avon and Wiltshire NHS Mental Health Partnership, they take referrals from around the southwest of England, working with children and young people with problematic or harmful sexual behaviour and their families. That's the whole family response we heard about earlier. They've allowed us to record them at the clinic, which is pretty rare. When this family first came to them for help, they were in a bad way.
I think a huge struggle was finding a way to make sense of why this had happened in their family, what had led to it taking place. And that can be really complicated to work out the factors that might lead a child to act out sexually towards another sibling. Families lose their confidence. They can feel that they are being blamed at times, maybe by professionals. So to try and minimise that, to get rid of that stuff and help families build their own strengths really is hugely important.
For months, Paul and the team worked with the entire family, both parents and both children. Here, they create a safe place to talk about the worrying sexual behaviour and through therapy and education, discuss the difference between what's safe and what's inappropriate.
It was like a weight lifted off. I learnt to appreciate my son for who he is rather than what he'd done, like to see past behaviour and focus on the future and his qualities. He's this really funny little cheeky chap. He was diagnosed with learning difficulties, but he just wants everyone to smile and be happy. He just wants everyone to be his friend. Yeah, it's definitely helped our relationship.
Did you ever think at that beginning, you know, at that meeting at the beginning when social came to your house, that there would be a way out?
No, not at all. I just didn't think any help was available. I thought sort of like this is the only family it's happened to. Not sort of the only, but like, you know, it wasn't as common as what it is. I really did fear for the worst. It's made me more aware, you know. I thought keeping my children inside was keeping them safe, but actually the dangers are inside as well as outside. You just got to be right on it to keep them safe.
I think sibling sexual abuse is often hidden in all families of all classes and all backgrounds.
Stephen Barry is the lead clinician at BeSafe. He's been working in this field for 25 years and is convinced that working with the child alongside their family is the way to go.
Therapists often talk about this idea about, you know, behaviour tells us something. So if a child is behaving in a certain way, they're also communicating something. So what are they communicating about their life experience?
He says that although what they're doing isn't revolutionary, it is rare.
There are no services in some authorities, and across the country the picture's really patchy, and they often look to the independent or charitable sector to provide those services, and they also are struggling for funding, so the services start to close down. So I actually think we almost have less provision now than we did 2 years ago, which I think is tragic.
That's not the only challenge. Stephen says even when there are services, there can be long waits, and there aren't enough specialist services available for the children who have been harmed. Therapist Paul Kelly again.
I think the family have come a long way. I think the journey of telling their story, of starting to find ways to process the trauma, I think it's fair to say, and you know, okay to say that I think there were a number of challenges broader outside of the family that might have impacted on them struggling more than maybe another family might.
And what have you seen a change in the children as well?
They made huge progress in being able to playfully talk about stuff, but also really be able to name feelings and what have you. But I would still say they've got a long way to go, really.
What's clear is that when it comes to sibling sexual abuse, nothing is easy. But this sounded like progress. Of all the families I've spoken to, Jenny's got by far the most support. Many families get much less, if anything at all. When cases like this are reported to the authorities, the police are often called in to explore the possibility of a conviction. As part of the Sibling Sexual Abuse Project run by Fleur Strong, the team submitted a Freedom of Information request to all the police forces in England and Wales. They wanted to find out how often sibling sexual abuse was reported to and recorded by police. And they've given us exclusive access. They're pretty sure this is the first time anyone has asked this question, and they weren't prepared for the results.
So basically one in four or quarter, 24% of all reported incidences of sexual offences and sexual assault within the family where the victim was under 18, the individual perpetrating that assault was a sibling. That absolutely astonished the project because we were not expecting such a high percentage to come back to us. Because what that indicates, it indicates that actually the problem is very, very large, because if we've got such a large number of reported incidents and we know that actually it's the least likely form of abuse to be reported, you begin to get a picture as to how big it could be.
The figures only relate to cases reported to police. Who knows how many don't? They submitted the request to all 43 police forces across England and Wales. 27 got back to them, but they could only reliably use data from 21. So they found between 2017 and 2020, almost 12,000 incidents of sexual abuse within the family were recorded by police, and that's where the victim was under 18. Of those, just under 3,000 were recorded as a sibling relationship. So that includes full siblings, step or half siblings, and adopted and foster siblings. 40% were recorded as parent-child relationship, and the rest were other family members. While it's clear many police forces record sibling sexual abuse, not all do. Fleur Strong thinks this is problematic.
I have never come across a situation other than before Rotherham where I have identified such a high level of systematic and wide-ranging resistance to acknowledge that this type of child sexual abuse is happening. The scale of it is shocking, but everything around me doesn't acknowledge that scale. Every single statutory document, every piece of important information around safeguarding children, as a rule, does not even name it. And I find that a struggle.
Fleur thinks this makes it harder to get to grips with how common it is, which could mean when people go looking for help, often it's not there.
It has a huge impact because if it's not there, it is not measured. And if it is not measured, potentially there is no funding for it, there is no priority for it, there is no training. Because why would you train? Why would you fund? Why would you support people who have experienced an abuse that officially doesn't exist?
There's been some progress on that front. A few weeks ago, the Office for National Statistics confirmed they would start collecting data around sibling sexual abuse in their crime survey.
We asked the Home Office about the issues raised in the programme. They told us they're committed to tackling all forms of child sexual abuse and fund organisations that provide specific guidance and support for those who have experienced sibling sexual abuse.
When it comes to prosecuting children in these cases, it can be controversial.
I think what we understand from children and from research with children who have experienced sibling sexual abuse is that whilst they desire some kind of form of justice, they have found a criminal justice response an extremely difficult one for them to cope with.
Dr. Peter Yates from the University of Edinburgh again. Many think that where a crime has been committed, justice should be served. And while Dr. Yates thinks there are undoubtedly cases where children should be prosecuted for what they've done, it's not always the case.
I wouldn't want to say categorically that a criminal just response is always inappropriate. However, that can sometimes be, you know, quite long and quite drawn out and very difficult, both for the child but also for the wider family as that unfolds, and can sometimes then make it very difficult for the family to get on with the more kind of therapeutic and restorative work that they would need to undertake in order to start to repair some of their relationships and start to tackle some of the underlying reasons for the abusive behaviour having taken place in the first place.
One thing I've learned making this programme is that when this happens in a family, there's no one way that people respond. I've spoken to families torn apart as well as those who've somehow managed to keep it together. Some families are open and honest, while others do all they can to pretend it never happened. Feelings of fear, guilt and shame seem to be universal though. Pretty much everyone feels at least one of those. And as I've discovered, adults abused by their siblings when they were children can find it incredibly hard to tell anyone what happened when they were younger. Some stay silent for decades. And when they finally speak their truth, the desire to find some kind of justice for what happened is strong.
Kath, is that you?
Yeah, that's me and the dog Skip.
Skip?
Yeah, he was a really good dog. I used to sit on him and ride round, just run around the house.
Look at your hair.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons, I haven't been able to speak to the children involved in any of these cases. They're just too little. But I wanted to speak to someone who had experienced this firsthand. So I travelled to Leeds to meet Kath.
Wow. And who's in this one?
So that's the oldest, me in the middle, and then the middle brother. So
you're the youngest?
The youngest, yeah.
I was the youngest.
And the hair, yeah, long blonde hair, nice and curly. Yeah, cute.
Kath's in her 30s now, but grew up in a small village in West Yorkshire. An everyone knows everyone kind of place. Barbecues with neighbours, football in the street. It was nice. Safe. But all that changed one night when she and her eldest brother went to stay with her granddad.
Because I was younger, I went to bed earlier. We were sharing a bed, essentially, and he came to bed normally, if you like, and then after a while he was sort of asking the questions like, oh, do you want to cuddle like mummies and daddies? Do you want to... So you get on top of me, and then it sort of... One thing sort of led to another, if you like, but... Not in a sort of consensual way, really, because I didn't really know what was happening.
That night, Kath's eldest brother raped her. She was 7 years old. For the next 3 to 4 years, she was subjected to the most serious and sustained sexual abuse. Night after night, he would sneak past his parents' room and into Kath's.
Yeah, I can remember one occasion. He was saying to me, shout for mum then, shout for her then. sort of goading me. And I couldn't, my little body just couldn't do it. I really wanted to. And I'm all my might to try and shout, and a little whisper came out. And I, looking back now, obviously it was a protection thing, but I felt like I'd let myself down, like, you know, because I just couldn't do it. And he knew, and he was laughing at me.
It wasn't until the night before her 32nd birthday, a quarter of a century after the abuse had first started, that she was finally able to tell her family what had happened. By then, she'd got married, had a baby, built a life. But she could not shake what had happened to her.
I was at a point where I either tell my family or I kill myself. That was literally at the point I was at. And obviously I had a little boy and I had all these things, but it didn't matter. I couldn't, it was... People had to know the truth, or, you know, I couldn't go on. I couldn't do it. And obviously, if you could hear a heartbreak, you'd have heard it in that moment. You know, my mum's colour just drained completely from her face, and she just cried. And my dad put his head down, and I think his head's still down to this day. Do you know what I mean? He is still in this sort of denial, whatever you want to call it.
Up until now, I've spoken mostly to parents fighting to protect one or both of their kids, or professionals who step in after the fact and try to help pick up the pieces. This is the first time I've spoken to someone who has actually endured the abuse. Speaking to Kath, what was so clear was the sheer weight of responsibility she felt when she was a kid. Not just for what had happened, but for keeping the family together. She carried this secret around for decades because she didn't want to destroy what she considered to be the most important thing in her life.
And I can remember lying in bed and I was sobbing, I was crying so much. Like, and I can remember thinking, this is the most lonely place. Like, my mum's next door, my other brother's in the bedroom, the people that I love are right here, and I am in the most lonely place I've ever been in all my life. And it's torture, it's horrible, it's... Because you know that they're there. Like, I knew my mum was right there. But how could I ever tell her? How could I ever say, this is how I feel and this is what's happening? Like, where do you go?
Family relationships endure, you know, right across the lifetime. And that, you know, there's pressure on families to come together again at birthdays or at weddings, at funerals, at, you know, other kind of family events. And these kind of situations could be, you know, extremely stressful, really fraught, if not really quite unsafe for family members, if some of the underlying issues haven't been addressed.
Dr. Peter Yates from the University of Edinburgh again.
Do you think it is possible for a family to recover from an incident like that?
It is possible, and certainly experiences that it is possible for families to do that. So not to say that that's easy, and I think that families certainly require outside support in order to manage the fallout. So it may not be possible in all cases for family members to live together again under the same roof. That may not be the outcome, but we would hope that they would find ways of remaining as a family in whatever form that can be.
And if they can't?
I think the long-term outcomes for children who have been harmed through sibling sexual abuse, if it's not adequately addressed, can be, you know, can be extremely difficult for them. They may continue to feel ongoing kind of post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms and relationship difficulties really kind of throughout their lifetimes.
After she told her family, Kath did go to the police. She says it wasn't necessarily about wanting her brother to go to prison. It was more what she called future-proofing, making sure he wasn't a danger to anyone else. Even though he admitted it, police didn't charge him because at the time the abuse happened, there was a defence in law that a child under 14 years old was presumed incapable of committing a crime. Instead, Kath went through a restorative justice process, sat in a room with her brother and told him face to face the effect of what he'd done to her for all those years. Did it help?
I think it did in terms of everyone got to say what they wanted to say. I think in situations like this, particularly sibling sexual abuse, there's no sort of thing to say, this will make you feel better, this will make you feel happy, you'll find an answer if you go here. You know, I've looked everywhere for answers and there just isn't any.
Given everything I'd learned before I met her, I asked if she thought a whole family therapeutic response could have helped her all those years ago. She said that's difficult. She stayed silent for years because she didn't want to destroy her family. Even if she had disclosed when she was a child, she's worried she might have gone along with family therapy, even if she didn't want to, just to keep the peace.
I do think that professionals are sort of searching for a reason or an excuse or an answer to why somebody's done something. Hello, I've just told you that he raped me. Like, I'm here, right here. So if someone's done something to him, then yeah, that's terrible and it's awful. But that's separate to what's happened to me. Who cares? I don't care what happened to him. I care about what happened to me, that little girl inside me.
This is one of the trickiest stories I've ever worked on. A story that challenged my ideas about innocence and justice, about right and wrong, about our darkest fears realised. Many of the professionals I spoke to think now that we're starting to get to grips with how common it could be, this form of abuse should be named and prioritised in safeguarding policies, so that families like Kate's get the help they need.
I told them I needed help. You know, you need to take it seriously. This is a child. She's been abused and she needs help. I thought she would get counselling. To be fair, right from day dot, I thought surely they'll put her in some kind of counselling. Or the option that if I thought she was struggling, to have help. But it was like, no one wanted to listen.
That's the thing. Of all the people I spoke to while making this programme, the one thing they all wanted was for the voices of the families affected by this to be heard, so that when it does happen, we can do something about it.
Sometimes it's just nice to know that there is people out there that are not going to put it back in the box. You know, they're going to talk about it because this is happening. Like, even now, you know, it's happening and it's prevalent. It's important to discuss it so that young people, young adults, can see that there is sort of hope, if you like, and there is light at the end of the tunnel and life can get better.
This File & 4 podcast was presented by Livy Haydock and produced by Ailis Hart. It was a BBC long-form audio production for BBC Sounds, where you can find more radio, music and podcasts.